My name's Sarah Metcalf, one of the medical editors of Australian Family Physician, and I have with me today Professor John Dixon, who's the NHMRC Senior Research Fellow and Head of the Clinical Obesity Research, Vascular and Hypertension Division at Baker IDI and Diabetes Institute and the Department of General Practice, the Faculty of Medicine at Monash University. Welcome, Professor.
Hi there.
Okay, and today we're discussing obesity and the recommendations for the management in general practice and beyond. So obviously the levels of overweight and obesity in our community now are really quite staggering. I think over 60% of adults and 25% of children and adolescents. And these numbers are only predicted to increase in the coming years, not to mention the healthcare costs that are associated with the problem. What are some of the determinants of overweight and obesity? It's clearly a very complex problem, or our efforts at prevention wouldn't be failing so comprehensively.
Yes, it is far more complex a problem than many of us have realised. We've got to go beyond the big two, and that is blaming our food intake or blaming our exercise or lack of exercise. We've had clearly changes in diet. We've had clearly changes in our food production and changes in how we move for the essentials of life. But we've got to consider other things that have changed our lives. We've had more sedentary occupations. Sleep times have decreased. There's higher levels of depression and stress. And simple environmental things, like we all live in air-conditioned rooms and apartments and things and houses, and it takes the energy expenditure of maintaining our temperature away.
Yes.
So it's a real issue. Now, probably the most important thing that we're learning is that the weight trajectory or your likely weight through life is determined very early on. That is, you know, how mums are prepared for pregnancy, the programming of the genes and the programming of the fetus, metabolic programming, and how we treat our children in the first few years of life. There's a real thought now that you know, if you get to school and you've got a weight problem, and certainly if you're in secondary school and you've got a weight problem, you're going to have that problem for life.
Yes, I mean, that's an area that's only going to grow as we learn more and perhaps focus our energies at prevention at that stage more so.
Absolutely. We need to do more research. We need to be able to give general practitioners far clearer guidelines than they have today about how we can, you know, prevent and how we should be looking after mothers, pregnant mothers, and the pregnancy, and how we should be caring for those first vital years of life.
And obviously, being overweight or obese has the potential to adversely affect health in many different areas, and perhaps beyond the obvious of cardiovascular disease and diabetes that are top of mind.
Absolutely. I think the thing that obese people will very quickly talk about, which is top of their mind, is their quality of life, their mobility, their ability to function, arthritis, difficulty with exercise. There's so many physical things that are a problem. And on the other hand, there are mental issues as well. There's discrimination, stigmatization. There's issues of depression, stress. Very large numbers of our severely obese population suffer from depression. And it's so hard to get them to focus on the lifestyle choices we'd like to have them make when they've got so much psychological baggage, and we've got to look after that.
Yes, and obviously many of our patients in general practice have these problems, and there's obviously good awareness that we need to address this factor to improve health, but I think it can be difficult to know how to go about it. Are there some principles you can suggest to sort of help guide in approaching the management of these patients?
Well, I think the first thing that I do is to try and... the first principle is to engage the patient in not a blame game to say, well, you must have been non-compliant or you mustn't be sticking to your diet, not, but it's to engage the patient in an understanding that they have a disease, an understanding that they have disability and dysfunction that you want to help with. I mean, it's no, in general practice, we do this all the time with chronic disease. And it's not necessarily whether they're ready for a treatment, it's understanding that you're able to help, because so often our obese people tell us that, well, they're not really going to health practitioners of any type for their, you know, they'll be at Weight Watchers or somewhere else. So that's the first thing, engage them. And then the second thing is to talk to them about what's wrong with this condition. What, how does it affect me, my function, my psychological well-being? How does it affect the way I'm living my life? And that's a better focus than on saying, well, you've just got to lose so much weight and this is your target and yes. So forth. So it's very much engaging the patient and saying, I understand your problem. I understand you've tried so many times to lose weight, but let's see if we can improve your other conditions, and let's see if we can get the pattern right, the conditions right, so that we can change your health, even if we are only able to achieve modest weight loss.
Yeah, so it's really shifting that focus, isn't it, from something that people have often struggled with for many, many years and become to a point where they think there's nothing they can do about it.
That's right. Both the patient and the practitioner are frustrated, whereas we've learnt in other areas of practice, treating depression, treating cancer, treating heart disease, treating diabetes, that we've got a list of things we can do to not cure the condition, but to treat the patient and their condition, and to understand that there is such an important element in getting the patient to engage in their disease, and to understand that we'll work with them and change their lifestyle for the health outcomes, but not, we don't want them to, we're not, our aim is not necessarily going to be to bring them down to a normal weight.
No. So I guess in line with that, John, what are the management targets we should really be aiming for?
Well, I think they vary with a person's age, their gender, and their comorbidity, their conditions. So I think we should be quite flexible. Also, we need to think that targets need to be realistic, and goal setting can be a real problem if our goals and the patient's goals are together and they're right, but they're impossible to achieve for the vast majority. So what we have to do is to start thinking about 5 and even 10% weight loss. But I think if we can achieve 5% weight loss in some people, we know that there are great health benefits, and we shouldn't be concerned about any degree of weight loss. Any degree of weight loss is an advantage. So if we focus on 5, and you know, sometimes I see people who've already lost 5 or 10% of their body weight, and the first thing I'll tell them is how successful they've been at losing weight and keeping some off.
Yes, and it's that keeping it off too that's a really important element, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a challenge. It's an important challenge. And there are many, many suggestions that, you know, as to how we can do that. But it's often tinted with the disappointment that you haven't lost more, and I think that's always difficult. I think we've got to recognise the health benefits of modest weight loss and realise that it's interesting that there's often a non-linear relationship between improvement in health and weight loss. Yes. Most of the advantages are occurring in the first 5 to 10%.
Yes, and I guess that's similar, you know, as a GP, you do see a lot of patients who are really making an effort with their lifestyle changes. You know, they come and tell you that they've decreased their portion size, they're exercising 5-6 times a week, and they're just not seeing that weight loss. And obviously, there's lots of reasons for that. And I think in line with what we were saying earlier, it's about focusing on what they have achieved, perhaps, and benefits beyond the weight loss that they might be seeing.
That's correct. I think we've got to work out we've got to obviously have some strategies for those that have got severe complex obesity. But for the majority of people that GPs are seeing in the overweight or class one obese category, less than BMI 35, they've got to work with their patients on some of these factors, which are actually quite simple, but not have the expectation and or agree with the patient's expectation that we're seeking a target that's a very low weight. I set targets in very small increments rather than tell someone they're going to lose 20 or 30 kilograms.
Yes. And I guess that leads us on to talk about some of the more intensive weight loss interventions. And there is a fair bit of evidence that some of those result in greater sustained weight loss than if we're just looking at diet and exercise alone. So firstly, very, very low energy diets. And they're a treatment that seems to be underutilised in general practice, really.
Yes, I think they're very underutilized. When I talk to general practitioners, as I do regularly, I think it's between 1 in 10 and 1 in 20 GPs who have an interest in weight loss actually use this tool. Very low calorie diets are important because we can get really quite substantial weight loss, and there is a myth about weight loss, and that the myth is that if you lose weight quickly, that's not all that healthy, and you'll put it all on quickly, and you've wasted your time. The truth is, there's solid facts that if you lose more weight in your initial weight loss program, then you will retain more weight loss in the long term. And so it's a bit counterintuitive to the advice that many dietitians would give.
Yeah.
But to achieve substantial weight loss and then follow it with a program of diet and exercise. And patients are stimulated by the fact that, look, I'm having this medically supervised special diet, it's working, and the incredible thing is, and I'm not hungry now. And it works in a special way to do that. So they are underutilized. I'm suggesting that people have to know how to prescribe them and how to work with them. And it's very important for the general practitioner to have a dietitian or one of their practice nurses or someone that they can, you know, teach or have trained the use of these diets, because that's when, you know, the patient needs to be able to call you up when there's a minor problem or an issue that are predictable, and then get the benefits of this sort of diet. We also transition off these diets, and we can use meal replacements intermittently. And for a lot of patients, you know, putting themselves back on a very low calorie diet just for 2 weeks every now and then is enough to maintain quite substantial weight loss. So they're a great tool, but they do take learning. If people just expect to go away and use them, and they'll be frustrated.
Yeah.
Important area of frustration is that you, in the first few days while taking them, you get hungry, of course, as you lose weight. But after you develop ketosis, after you've starting to burn fat, you lose hunger altogether. It's great. So people can stay on less than 800 calories a day and not be hungry. So they lose a lot of weight.
Yeah. And are there any adverse effects that they can have using these diets?
Importantly, they're like prescribing anything. There are contraindications, such as pregnancy and people who've got cardiovascular disease and various things. Mm-hmm. People need to know the contraindications, and there are common side effects. I think people often complain that their skin's dry. They often complain early on when on a very low calorie diet that there's constipation. We need to sometimes increase fiber. They'll often find that they're a bit lightheaded at times if they haven't had enough to drink, and because their blood pressure's fallen. But they are common, they're predictable, and none of them are serious. And
no.
So, the nurse or the dietitian needs to be comfortable with all the issues and problems that can come up, and they are indeed very safe treatment.
Yes, and you know, there's some recommended, you know, frequency of review when people are on these, and also some monitoring in the form of some blood tests initially, and then repeat it if people are going to be staying on the diets for a longer period of time.
Absolutely. This is medical supervised weight loss. It's something that's done in primary care. It's done, and when I say primary care, that's the nurse, that's the diet, you know, the team are involved. And we do a set of bloods beforehand. They're all associated with the recommendations with the products. And if people are going to be on them, if there's any condition, of course, where they're on medications, doses may need to be adjusted for the change in diet and et cetera, like with warfarin. And we sometimes find that other drugs will develop more toxic levels in people losing weight rapidly. So these are the sort of things that a doctor needs to be involved in this process. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if we're going to use it beyond 3 months, and it can be used quite safely 3 months, we would repeat our blood tests at that time. And we don't often see any problems, but of course, if there are electrolyte issues or renal problems and other things, they're relative contraindications, but there's also guidance in the literature with these products to tell about, you know, when you should be stepping up and repeating things like electrolytes, etc.
Yes, okay. And there are obviously various pharmacotherapies available for the treatment of obesity as well. How effective are they, and when should we be thinking about using these sorts of therapies?
Well, currently we have very few that are available. Of course, we have Orlistat, which has been around for a long time and is now available across the counter, a lipase inhibitor. And the other drug that we've had around for a long, long time is phentermine. The common product names for those for phentermine is Duramine. And these drugs are not used commonly. However, these drugs do have a sound place, and new ones will be coming on board hopefully soon.
Yeah.
Phentermine is a very good appetite suppressant, and I find that it's useful, for instance, in the first few days while starting someone on a very low-calorie diet. I'll find that they're useful when people are coming off a very low-calorie diet because their hunger is likely to increase.
Mm.
Phentermine can control that hunger and therefore produce a sense of feeling of control. And again, all drugs have indications, contraindications, precautions that the general practitioner needs to know about. I also would suggest phentermine's useful. You know, it's often very useful, used as an every other day dose. And while people, you know, can use it for, you know, 30 tablets, repeat, etc., to use it strategically can be very, very useful. So I find it when person feels out of control with their diet, that's when it can be very useful. Orlistat, the lipase inhibitor, I find quite useful in people who don't know how much fat's in their diet, and they will have adverse events, effects, bowel effects with that. But also, it's actually quite useful in people with diabetes, with high lipids, and so forth. And in diabetics, it's so important to be able to get just a little bit of weight, you know, a little bit of extra weight loss. So I think it can be very useful there. We are expecting some drugs on the horizon, and two new preparations have been approved by the FDA in the US recently, so hopefully we'll have some better things coming. One of them is interesting. It's a drug called Qsymia, which is a combination of phentermine and topiramate, that Wow. anti-epileptic drug that's around it, that, you know, that they're using at the moment. And those two together in low dose have been found to be quite effective. In fact, producing better weight loss than any other formulation that we've had to date.
Oh, well, it sounds like it might be promising.
Yes. Yes. It's promising. And I think we need, I want to emphasise to all GPs, I mean, they have no question about using medications in combination to treat hypertension, diabetes, dyslipidemia or anything, asthma, and
yes.
lots of other things. Obesity, we hope in the future, and many of its comorbidities, will be able to be treated effectively with combinations of chemotherapy, of drugs,
yes.
combination drugs, along with lifestyle and dietary advice, etc.
Yes, and it's probably a good time to point out within the article in this month's issue, there's some great tables that detail some of the things we're talking about. So, and there's one particularly on the pharmacotherapies and some more detail about that. So I encourage people to actually have a look at those as well.
Yes.
Okay, and so next I guess we move on to bariatric surgery. It's been getting more attention in recent years as one of the most effective ways to manage obesity. Could you just briefly go through the common procedures that are performed in Australia and which patients should we be thinking about this surgery in?
Yes, well, I think it's a very important area because we as general practitioners are always confronted by the person with severe complex obesity and have failed all other treatments. And bariatric surgery really does produce sustained weight loss. We have three common procedures available in Australia. One is the laparoscopic adjustable gastric band, which has been around for a long time now, and it's been commonly used in Australia. In fact, we've probably led the world in its use. The second is a procedure, a newer procedure, which has become quite popular. It's called a sleeve gastrectomy. It's a removal of much of the stomach, just leaving a sleeve of stomach between the esophagus and the duodenum. Many surgeons have found that to be useful. It produces quite rapid weight loss. And the third procedure, which is the commonest procedure in the world for bariatric surgery, is called a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, but it's not all that commonly used in Australia. And I think most GPs will probably find that when they're referring to surgeons, they're typically getting either the laparoscopic adjustable gastric band, of which the commonest type is the lap band, and then or the sleeve gastrectomy. But I think that the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass is one of the oldest, and it's a really very very good procedure.
Right. And then obviously there are specialists in management of obesity such as yourself, and I think the input can be difficult to come by. It's one of the big problems with our system that there's a bit of a lack of access to these sorts of services, and it can be quite frustrating for doctors and for patients. Is it only those patients with the most comorbidity and at the most severe end that we should be thinking about referring to these services?
No, I don't think so. And I think there's an important message here. I think everyone with a body mass index over 40 and certainly over 50, and GPs have all got patients with a body mass index over 50, we should be arguing for those very big people to have access to surgery. Now, the sad thing is that there's more people in that category in the lower socioeconomic groups in our community, the less well-educated, the less well-employed, and the other interesting thing is that the majority of them are women. Two-thirds of them at least are women, and that's something that's not often understood. And so it's low socioeconomic, low education, low access to private health insurance where the dominant issues are, and yet the more than 9 out of 10 of these procedures are done within the private health system. So that equity of access is a tragedy for the severely obese. Other groups that should be thought of are people with a body mass index less than 30, between say 35 and 40, where they have illnesses such as diabetes or severe obstructive sleep apnea, etc. Conditions related to their obesity that will respond to weight loss. But there's a real important message here that these respond to weight loss much better if we refer them for surgery at a time before we've given up on everything else. When a patient's had diabetes for 10 years and is on insulin and has very little residual beta cell function. They don't produce much insulin themselves. We can't expect their diabetes to go into remission with bariatric surgery.
No.
But if we find that after 2 or 3 years of treatment, they're really not reaching target, they're still obese, we're thinking of now adding insulin or Byetta or something else, that's the time that we should be adding the prospect of bariatric surgery for those over a BMI of 35.
Yes. So think of it sooner rather than, as a very last resort.
Because we can get the weight loss and we can put their diabetes into remission. And I think this also applies for the other comorbidities as well. We shouldn't be waiting till their end stage or it's almost palliative disease. We should be thinking of those people at an earlier phase. Same with very, very big people. We don't want to sit watching them grow when they've got this serious disease. We need to get in effectively when we recognise that other therapies are not working.
Okay, so in summary, John, it sounds like the recognition of obesity as a complex chronic disease is integral to managing it successfully. Are there any other messages that you'd like GPs to take away and integrate into their practice?
Well, I think the first one is to engage the obese people in their disease. Engage them, not blame them, but engage them in as being part of, I can help. And I can provide advocacy for you like I can provide advocacy for my other patients. Mm. The second one is to recognize that modest weight loss is very useful and that we must work on that clearly. I think the third thing is to make sure that they team up, find people in their area who are prepared to work enthusiastically to try and improve the health and quality of life of these patients. The nurse, the dietitian, the community health centre, Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, it's a team effort and we can't leave it up to the GP.
Yes, great. Well, thanks very much for your time today, Professor Dixon. It was really, really helpful.
Thanks, Sarah.